Everyone, thanks for tuning in to another episode of WISER. I'm Megan Wasson, a third-year medical student at Emory and event coordinator for WISER. I'm joined today by Shannon Sue.
Hi, I'm Shannon Sue, a current third-year medical student and VP of WISER at Emory University School of Medicine. Today, we are honored to have Dr. Angela Cheng with us on this podcast. She is an esteemed faculty in the plastic surgery department here at Emory University who specializes in breast reconstruction, microsurgery, lymphedema surgery, and body contouring. She's also the chief of plastic surgery at Grady and the assistant program director for the independent program. Dr. Cheng got both of her undergraduate and medical degrees from the University of Florida. Then she completed her general surgery residency at the University of Texas in Houston, followed by plastic surgery residency at the University of Virginia and a fellowship in breast and microsurgery at UT Southwestern. Welcome, Dr. Cheng, and thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much. Just to get some things started, could you maybe introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about yourself?
Okay. So I am one of Emory's plastic surgeons. I've now been on faculty for about 12 years. My clinical practice is split actually between the Grady campus and the Emory main campus. So I spend half my time in each location. So as part of that, I get to supervise the residents and train the residents in a variety of cases ranging from head and neck trauma, facial trauma to general reconstruction, and then complex reconstruction, including microsurgery for things like breast reconstruction and even limb salvage. I'm also, I would say, proud dog mom of two. I would say I'm an associate professor now of the Division of Plastic Surgery and the assistant program director for the independent plastic surgery residency program.
Cool. And just to clarify for our listeners, so the independent program is the one that you apply to after general surgery residency, is that right?
That's right. So we have two residency programs. We take two each. And so two of our residents a year come out of medical school. And then the other two have either most likely completed general surgery, but actually you can complete a couple other specialties, including ENT, oral surgery, urology, ortho, and neurosurgery, and take the independent track, which is also known as the traditional track. And I actually did the traditional track myself.
Interesting. I didn't know you could come from neurosurgery. That seems a little bit counterintuitive. But just to bring it back, like all the way to the beginning, do you think you could tell us a little bit about what drew you to surgery and then what drew you to plastics during your residency?
Sure. So I was lucky enough, like you ladies, to get to rotate on plastic surgery as a third year medical student. Where I did medical school, it was a elective month followed by a general surgery month or vice versa. And I chose plastic surgery, and it was very competitive, obviously, because I felt like it was a good match for what I thought I might be interested in. And everyone said it was a great rotation, of course, and you had to do a lot of sewing. But I've always been kind of an artist on the side and really enjoy puzzles as well. Visual spatial skills are kind of one of my strengths. And so I got an exposure to sort of plastic surgery in high school when my brother had to have a little cyst on his forehead removed. And what I thought was really cool was he also took care of his hand, had a little cyst as well. And I really got to understand a little bit better that plastic surgeons do operate all over. And it's not just, you know, boob jobs, Botox, tummy tucks, and things like that. So I spent a little time shadowing him back then. So I went through medical school and just still fell in love with surgery. It's just super gratifying to make an instantaneous change with your hands and, you know, really making a difference in these patients' lives, not just how they look, but a lot of what we do is improving function as well, or restoring function. So that's what finally drew me to kind of the reconstructive aspect of plastic surgery.
That's amazing. And even just the 2 weeks that I was on plastics, I could tell that art was very much at the core of what you all were doing. And it was really cool to participate in that aspect of it. It sounds like art is something that you were interested in kind of from a young age. I'm wondering if you could explore that a little bit more with us.
Yeah, so I'm that kid that was always doodling in their notebook. And then since I have Asian parents, my mom was always like, "Stop drawing." You know, Asian parents are very harsh on their kids as far as like, you can't make a living as an artist. You've got to have a real job. So I got to draw when I was done with my schoolwork. But then when I realized I could find a job that really married those two, that was an amazing opportunity where in some ways we're sculpting human flesh. When I do a deep flap to do a breast reconstruction, I'm taking extra ugly lower abdominal skin and fat and then restoring and making beautiful breasts for these patients and then flattening their tummies. And so they leave hopefully better than they started with, which is just a really great feeling.
Yeah, I was in a deep kiss with you when I was on my 2 weeks, and that was exactly it. So you proved him wrong. You are making money as an artist.
My medium today is not pencil, is not watercolor, is not clay. It is human flesh, for better or
Yeah.
worse. But I think that's part of the fun. I don't do a lot of cosmetic surgery personally on the face. A lot of my partners do that really well, but I think that's what's great about this specialty is there are so many different aspects that you can still find something that interests you or you're passionate about.
Yeah. Do you think you could also talk a little bit about what drew you exactly to microsurgery and reconstruction?
Yeah, so microsurgery is a subspecialty of plastic surgery, and it does re require an additional year of fellowship training. But there are different aspects of microsurgery. So some of my partners are hand microsurgeons. There are people who are more head and neck microsurgeons, and I would say mine is more of a breast microsurgery training, and that's what my fellowship was. So during my residency, it was only 2 years. It's now a 3-year fellowship or residency program, as we said. I was exposed to what's called a TRAM flap, which is transverse rectus muscle flap, but none of the faculty did what we call DIEP flaps or what you saw, the deep flap. And I just felt, as a surgeon who wanted to do this type of reconstruction for patients in the future, that my toolbox would be incomplete without really learning how to do a deep flap and doing it well. I was interested in an academic job, and it just felt like I would be, you know, a carpenter without a wrench and missing a key tool. So I chose to spend an extra year to get extra training on doing that flap, which at the time wasn't quite as popular because it was much more technically difficult. And now it's become something that graduates from our residency program can go forth in the community and do without doing a fellowship training because it's something they're comfortable with doing so many in their residency program here at Emory.
Interesting, yeah. And what I think is crazy about you doing microsurgery is I remember at the breast symposium, you were one of two, maybe three women that presented. How have you been navigating this microsurgery space as obviously a minority and a woman?
Yeah, it's interesting you notice that. Actually, been actively trying to address that concern for the whole time I've been here. And this particular society, I think sadly, because we are in the Southeast as well, and it's sponsored by the Southeastern Society of Plastic Reconstructive Surgery, has been very male dominant. And in the past, all of the leadership in the society, as well as all the people who organized the symposium, we're talking about the Atlanta Breast Symposium, were men. And it was like basically couldn't get my foot in the door. The few women that used to be involved and had been involved had direct training relationships, meaning they were disciples of some of those people who organized the symposium. Dr. Loskin took it over a few years ago. And so he's been actively trying to improve that. And so he has been trying to get not just women, but fresh faces as well. It was, you know, important to grow as a meeting and not just invite the same people over and over again. I will say, as a woman in plastic surgery, we're already less common. I think the last time I checked our national society, we're 1 out of 8 for our microsurgery group.
That is a lot lower than I thought.
We have 3 women here out of 11 faculty, which is remarkable. There are quite a few residency programs who have no women faculty. So when we go to the microsurgery meetings as 1 out of 8, it might be a little bit better now, but I know when I started, they made an announcement the year I was a fellow attending it. And they're like, "We're up to 1 out of 8 members as women. Yay." And I was like, "Really?" But I could feel it. You could look around the conference and you just didn't see that many women. I'm delighted to say that that is not the case anymore as far as people at the meeting. So students like yourself, residents, fellows, the next generation, we know half of your medical school class are women. And that number is climbing steadily, and it's just sheer force. It's going to finally change. And then the women ahead of me have been very good about actually organizing women, because like you just said, sometimes the women out there were the only women at their program or the only woman in their practice. So they actually organized a women's microsurgery group. And so we have a special happy hour, we have a luncheon event, we even have a special retreat the day before the meeting that's just for us. And so it's really unified us and brought us together and made us realize that we are not alone, and we support each other and we help each other navigate the leadership process now. So I remember going for 4 years and not understanding, how do I get involved in this society? And I finally timidly approached this other woman, and I was like chasing her down after a meeting and a break. And I felt really awkward, but I was like, hey, I've been coming to this meeting for 4 years, but I don't understand how to get involved. Do you mind just letting me know what I can do? And she's been a great mentor and a great sponsor. And she's like, oh my gosh, I didn't know you were interested. Come to this meeting, do this, do that. And she's gotten me involved. I was then on the committee for several years, and I feel like now I've climbed that ladder. My role is to direct more women to be like, the ladder's right here, the door's right here, I've cracked it open, everybody come on in. Because now I have younger faculty from across the US and fellows that now also say, hey, how do I get involved? And it's kind of a mystifying process sometimes. You're like, I don't understand. And then we have actually set up mentor and mentees, and we have meetups during the meeting so that we can meet. Like this year, I was set up with a current fellow from Ohio State, and she just wanted advice about how to find a job and how to start her practice and things. So we are now, you know, women supporting women from above and below. This last year, we had a woman president of the American Society of Reconstructive Microsurgeon, which was only the second ever and had not happened in 18 years.
Oh my God.
So, and it's super exciting. This year, there's a woman president of the Aesthetic Society of Plastic Surgery, and she's only the second. Last year was the first. And a few years ago, the ASPS, which is one of our bigger organizations, also had a woman. I think she was the fourth or something. So we're still kind of little unicorns, but it's becoming more common. And so we just want to be good role models for the next generation and let them know that this is possible. And that's where I think, you know, I'm trying to help, like you said, Dr. Gabby Garcia, she's starting her practice as a junior faculty member, getting her involved. So when she comes to a meeting, I try to introduce her to everybody. So everyone knows, hey, this is somebody great. She's my new partner and she wants to be involved too. So I think networking is something that women naturally are pretty good at. Even, you know, we will chit chat about anything, but it's scary at first. And so I would just encourage women to not just look for mentors, but look for sponsors. And those are sometimes two different things. They can be the same person. Mentors are people who can give you advice, and sponsors are people who can actively promote your career. Whether it's giving you a paper to write, putting you on a panel, giving you leadership roles. So they have to themselves be in kind of a position of power to help you. And I've had my fair share of male and female sponsors and mentors. And that's just because there weren't very many women, obviously, ahead of me.
It sounds like you have done an amazing amount of work trying to break through in terms of being a woman in plastic surgery, and then also trying to keep the door open for other women. And that's really amazing to hear. And you kind of touched on this concept of the leaky pipeline. You wrote about this concept a few years back. I think it was in 2021 in the Journal of Plastic and Reconstructive Surgery. This concept of it being a little bit more difficult for women to make it all the way through medicine and then end up in a very specialized field like plastic surgery. And I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit more on that, and then more specifically about the ways that in your own work, you try and keep this door open for women and making sure that they make it all the way through this pipeline.
Yeah, so it's obviously tricky and you can't do it alone, right? Like I just said, you need people to help you from positions above and also people below you to support you to do this type of work. And it's not particularly as valued as number of cases you've done, right? That has a cash amount, that has a value, number of students you teach. This is something that's a little difficult to track. I would say it's frustrating when you look at the data and it's not clear why the pipeline leaks. And so for anybody who's not familiar, we have started to equilibrate in the number of women graduating, matriculating, and taking an academic job. So there are a ton of assistant professors, or much more now, but this doesn't translate into associate professor and full professor. Because years ago, people thought, okay, as the women come up through medical school and they now are 50% of the medical school class, we will see in 10 years this translate forward into professors. And it hasn't. There's a lot of thought and questions as to why this is happening. Clearly, one of them is family responsibilities. When you talk to a lot of women, they've delayed their childbearing years during residency. So once they get into practice, they're having their children, or they had children at the end of their residency, and now their children are becoming more important and being involved in their lives. And so women are more likely to have part-time roles or try to take time off of work. Another is that lack of support, either from their leadership, from their institution, not getting promoted, not getting opportunities for leadership like their male colleagues. And that is a common reason as well. Even within this institution and within our Department of Surgery, two people were hired at the same time, the man is more likely to get promoted before the woman. And why is that? We don't really understand that fully, but that is a trend. Is it because they aren't as focused on children and childcare and they're focusing more on research and lab? That may be part of it. And so therefore their CV is stronger. Women do tend to say no to opportunities to be asked to talk because they can't come because it's their kid's birthday or it's a key soccer game or something. So women do turn down opportunities for career advancement and things because of home priorities. For better or worse, I'm still single and don't have any home priorities. So I've been able to take advantage of those opportunities. But I know talking to one of our graduates who's now faculty elsewhere, she and her husband both finished at the same time. And she felt his career was advancing faster than his because she had issues during her pregnancy, had to take time off, could not travel, and things like that. And so she felt like her career development was stunted by childcare. You know, nowadays, I'm happy to say the last meeting, she brought her kid and her nanny and her mother-in-law. And she's like, I don't care, I'm coming. So there are solutions to working around that. Our speaker actually at the retreat this year was the new chair of the Department of Radiation Oncology at Emory. And it was amazing to see all the work she's done. She's published extensively where women faculty who do research and are trying to get grants just kind of fizzle out and don't go on to get the big R01 grants. But if you gave them a little extra money and a little extra time, then it started to even out that curve. So sometimes women need a little bit more support, a little bit more understanding, but it's hard to put that quantitatively. We're under so much pressure to produce and to take care of more patients and teach residents. And it's harder to put a value on some of the other stuff that we tend to do on the side. I don't have a solution for this leaky pipeline. Certainly equal pay will help. Women traditionally also, despite the fact it's 2024, get paid less. And this has also been studied. Men are much more willing to go ask for a raise. And if you're much more willing to go ask for a raise, maybe you don't get your first time, maybe you don't get your second time, but maybe you get your third or fourth time. And women are more likely to think, if I work hard, my boss will appreciate it and give me the raise. And unfortunately, it doesn't pan out. And it makes no sense that men should make more, but this data is out there. And at least in my specialty, the men sometimes are making 5 digits more. It's not a subtle difference. Yeah.
What do you mean by 5 digits more?
Like tens of thousands of dollars more. Now, that data is not perfect because it doesn't account for women who might be working part-time. Mm-hmm. And maybe their salary is based on time working, but this is national data that is the average female in each level, academic plastic surgery, whether it's assistant, associate, or full, makes less than their male counterpart.
I think it's it's even worse when you catch that in the context of what you were talking about previously with, in order for a lot of women to participate in conferences and be speakers and things like that, they have to make sure that they prioritize and pay for childcare and invite other family members and possibly pay extra money for family members to be in attendance at these things. So I think it's really interesting when you combine those two facets of it. The financial deficit is really tremendous.
Yeah, it's incalculable is the problem, right? And obviously not every woman has a child. Some women have multiple children and extended families. If you're lucky, they're nearby. If they're not, you're by yourself, right? So absolutely, there's a huge extra burden if you are a parent. And that's true of our male and female colleagues, but obviously women are more likely to be heavily involved in the childcare. So I challenge the next generation to fix this leaky pipeline, but there's a lot of holes where people fall out, I think is the problem. Some of it obviously is just frustrations, and some people naturally will fall out, men and women, just from wanting to change their practice, having more control over their practice. Recently, one of my male colleagues also just left Emory and went into private practice for multiple reasons. So it's not just women who leak out, but there is some attrition naturally to this process. People get comfortable, have an established patient care relationship, and are like, hey, I think I want to just do my own thing instead of being bound to some of the restrictions of academic plastic surgery. So there's good and bad. It's not perfect either way, but obviously in academics, I don't have control over as much over who my staff are. I can't hire my own nurse or my own assistant. Emory hires those people for us, and we work with them. But if you're in private practice and you don't like your front desk clerk, you can give them papers and hire a new one. So, but the advantages of academic surgery, I don't have to worry about that overhead. I'm not trying to balance my books and counting how many sutures I used versus how many staples and paper clips my office staff used. And I have a steady salary, unlike, my private partners in town during COVID, no patients, no surgeries, no income. And so that's something everyone has to think about very carefully when they make that decision, whether they want a private practice job or an academic job. And then, of course, there are hybrid jobs in between.
Yeah, you kind of mentioned earlier too that the reason you did fellowship and did micro fellowship was that you wanted to be in academics. Could you walk us through a little bit more about what went through that decision process?
Yeah, so I know you guys had a chance to kind of look over my CV. What I think doesn't reflect in my CV because it doesn't go back as far as high school, is that I've always loved teaching. And I do think some of this goes back to my grandfather. He was a teacher. And even in high school, I was the president of the peer tutoring club. So I would stay after hours to teach math. I was the TA for summer school for kids doing remedial math. And then when I went to college, I TA'd microbiology lab. And then when I went to medical school, I TA'd anatomy lab. So teaching has always been my passion. And I think that keeps this fresh for me as far as it's not just doing another breast reduction or another breast reconstruction. Every year, I get new excited students like you guys and new excited residents, and they are going to go on to do more good than I can do by myself. And that still motivates me and excites me. And a lot of my students will go on and exceed me and become even better surgeons than me. And that I think the closest I'm going to get to being a proud parent. So I've always just really enjoyed that moment when the light bulb goes on in the learner's head and they're like, oh my God, I get it. And then I am so excited because that's what I live for, that moment.
Yeah, from just these past few minutes of talking to you, I can really tell that paying it forward, whether it's with mentorship or with teaching, is very important for you. What would you say would be one thing that our listeners should take away from listening to this?
Obviously, this is very different for everybody. I think what I would tell myself looking back is ask and don't be afraid to ask. And people are genuinely interested in helping you. All of us in this field, we're physicians, we are caretakers, we want our students to succeed, we want our patients to do well. So I wish I had asked sooner about how to get involved, because I think that's something inherently within me is what part of being Asian as well is don't stir the pot, don't, you know, rock the boat, just, you know, be seen, don't be heard. I've had to get over that stigma. And so women are more prone to that. Feel free to ask for things you need for work. Block time in the OR. I didn't ask for 7 years until it got to be a breaking point for me that I was like, I can't keep doing my job. And when I brought it up, apparently Dr. Sweeney was dumbfounded that I didn't have block time. And they weren't even aware this was a problem I was dealing with. So I said to my junior partners who had the same problem when they first got here, no block time, start pushing for that now and what you need. And thankfully at 2 years now, they all have block time. So I think I would have asked sooner for things I needed to succeed. And obviously you can't come out as a fresh grad and ask, I want my own PA, I want my own secretary, I want everything. But truly what is critical to do your job? When you first negotiate for a job, that's the best time to ask for something, because once you're there, they're like, why do you need that? You didn't say you needed that, you know, when you took this job. Asking about how to get involved, asking who do I need to talk to for this? Hey, I want to be a part of this paper you guys are doing. I was kind of passive about that and thought, oh, if I just work hard and do my job, somebody will ask me to get involved. But people just were like, oh, I didn't realize you were interested in research. Oh, I didn't realize you were interested in this, right? And I do think, had I been more vocal about like, hey, I want to do this and hey, I want to do that, there were opportunities that certainly landed in my lap without me asking, but I think maybe I might have gotten more involved sooner and gotten more opportunities if I were a little bit more assertive about asking for things that I needed to do my job or to advance my career. I will say I've been involved in the Duke Flap course, which is an annual cadaver dissection course. And that was sort of serendipitously because of female residents and students asking why there were no women faculty to the program course director. And so year after year after year, there was never any women. And years ago, I had met the guy who became the course director at one of our national meetings, at our microsurgery meeting. And we just bonded over the fact we were both Florida Gators. And so he was like, well, I don't know who to ask. And then he just thought of me because we had met and stayed in touch professionally. So he was like, hey, my residents are asking me why there's no women. So do you want to be my token woman? And so for the first year I went, I felt like total imposter, right? I'm just here because I'm a woman, not because I'm qualified, not because I'm talented or smart, but he just needed to check a box. And I felt torn about that because I was like, none of us go into this job and want to be given a gold star just because you're a girl. You want to be told you're a great, whatever it is, and it shouldn't matter what your gender is. But I ended up kind of deciding, okay, whatever. If this is the reason the door got cracked open for me, I'm just going to step through it. And I'm going to prove that I'm worthy of this opportunity. But it was fascinating because afterwards, all these other women were like, how did you get invited into the secret club? And so that's why there's great he's for she's out there. I told the course director, hey, all these women are also interested. And he has subsequently gave them each opportunities to go as well. And now there's regularly a good variety of faculty at this course, but it just takes one sometimes. And you just never know how that opportunity will present itself. That wasn't because I asked. It just happened to be, I was kind of friends with him, but it was because the next generation asked and said, hey, why aren't there any women? And he never thought about it either. Nobody was actively thinking 10 years ago, why don't we have women? And so I did the same thing for the breast symposium. Like, hey, why don't we have more women speakers? Right. So I congratulate what you guys are doing with this type of work, asking these questions. How do we make a difference? And your generation is going to help turn that tide and where it's more balanced. It's never going to be, you know, perfect, but I do think it's going to be more balanced and it should be more balanced. There's clear data that women surgeons have better outcomes and patients are not stupid. They are going to ask for women surgeons. I, for better or worse, have a 6-month waiting list for some cases because patients are willing to wait for me because they want a woman or they want me because of somebody that gave them a favorable review. So do good work. Sometimes women have to do better work to be considered equivalent to their male colleagues, and then ask for opportunities, ask for things you are really passionate about that you need to succeed. The worst they can say is no. And then don't be heartbroken about it. Your male colleague probably was told no and didn't go home and sob about it. There's also studies too. When they post a job and there are 10 criteria, women will only likely apply if they meet all 10 criteria, right? But men will apply if they meet 2 to 3. And so, yes, they're more likely to get denied the job, but oh, they're okay with that. Whereas women are like, oh no, I don't have, you know, X, Y, or Z, so I'm not going to even apply. And so we have to push ourselves. And that's what our network of women microsurgeons do to each other. There's a traveling fellowship every year called the Godina Fellowship, which is very prestigious. And last year, only one woman had applied. And there's only ever been one woman winner in the program. And so three of us pushed each other to apply. And we each said to each other, we know we're not going to get it. Nobody gets it their first try. The guy who ended up getting it, it was his fifth try. And so we had to push each other and talk to each other and say, okay, we know we're not good enough for it now, but in 5 years, yeah, we're going to be good enough for this award to win it. So we have to start applying now. And that's how it works. Find your network, right? Like I said, sometimes you might be the only woman there, and talking to your friend who may be in a different state across this country, but it's the same problems. And just having that network and voice to say, oh yeah, I'm dealing with the same thing. Here's what I did to succeed. Here's what worked. Here's what didn't work. And sometimes sharing these stories, knowing you're not alone, can be just really powerful. It's a sisterhood in that sense, that we're very interested in most of the time supporting each other. I can tell the difference when I see the women ahead of us. They did not have that. They were the only woman hand surgeon, the only woman nerve surgeon. They scratched and clawed their ways into the boys' club, sometimes by stepping on other women or other men, because that's the only way they could get recognized and attain the status. The first woman president of the American Society of Reconstructive Microsurgery was one of the founding members, but it took her 8 years before they let her be president. Every other male founding member got to be president before her, not because she wasn't worth it, but that was just the world back then. And so now we don't see that as much, but it's very humbling to see where we've been, but it's very exciting to see where I think we can go.
Yeah, that's so interesting. You raise a lot of important points. And I think just in reflecting on how many barriers a lot of women previously and currently still face, it can kind of paint sort of a dismal picture, but I'm also hearing that there's a lot of hope here. I think the other interesting point too is, you know, in med school, we never have a class on how to advocate for yourself or a lecture on how to feel comfortable when you only meet 2 out of 10 criteria. It just sounds like it's kind of a skill that women really have to develop. While there's no formal instruction in it, this network of women is perhaps a way that we can kind of build each other up and make sure that women are brought to the table. So all of that is actually pretty encouraging to hear.
Yeah, it's really sad. Some people say imposter syndrome is not a real thing. The woman that I had reached out to and finally asked how to get involved, she presented this year that she had informally surveyed her medical students and residents about imposter syndrome. And she literally had a male resident say, I don't know what that is. I think awareness from our male colleagues is helping all these DEI work that's being done, not just for women, but for underrepresented and minority people, is helpful. Like, there's now a thought of, oh wait, we don't have any non-white male people on this panel. Maybe we should try to fix that, is much more actively discussed. I'm now on programming committees, and we are always striving for a diverse panel of not just older, we still want the older speakers, they have great experience, but we also want some up and coming talented people, whether they're male, female, trans, whatever it is, to have opportunities to share what they are able to do. So I do think there are more opportunities nowadays to get involved at a younger point in your career than there were in the past. And so that's why it is exciting for somebody like yourself, who's up and coming. You no longer have to wait until you're 10 years in practice to be worthy of being on a panel. There was a great panel just about things I learned in my first year of practice that I didn't learn in residency. And so there's always something that you can learn. You can go back and give a first year medical student a lecture, right? And they would be like, whoa, you know so much. and things that you didn't know that maybe if you were going back and give advice before doing a rotation, here's what you should do to prepare. This is what you should read, right? So every step, there's something you can pay forward to the next generation. Whether you think I'm just a medical student, I don't know anything. Well, guess what? That college student thinks you're amazing because you got into medical school. Or that high school student who's all they've ever seen is ER or they don't watch ER anymore, Grey's Anatomy. And they have no idea how to become a doctor, right? And so there's always information to be shared. Obviously COVID would happen and that would be my ticket to national fame amongst plastic surgery residents because of a very... sitting at home, quarantining in Chicago, in California. And so we started having visiting professors virtually. And then other programs were like, hey, we want in on this too. Our residents are also sitting at home doing nothing. And the next thing I knew, with the support of our two national societies, the Aesthetic Society and the ASPS, we launched national virtual grand rounds. Three times a week, myself, Dr. Noss, one of my partners, hosted a virtual grand round speaker and then like discussion afterwards. So I never saw a single one of these people because I was just the host and I couldn't see the audience. It's really awkward. I learned a lot about trying to interact with this Zoom screen without being able to get any audience feedback. But then years later, we were back in person, random residents would come up to me and be like, hey, you're Angela Chang. I watched you for months. And I was like, this is just so weird, right? Like, I had no idea. People recognized my voice because we were still wearing masks. And I was like, I never thought this would be what I'd be known for, but I just embraced that opportunity. You know, I thank the people who were in leadership positions to give me the platform and the ability to reach all residents. We peaked, I think during one session we had, there's about 1,000 residents in the US. There was one session, we had about 600 people attending. And the speaker joked with, I said, oh, we just broke a record. We had like over 600 people watching your lecture. And he's like, that's it. But it was just a weird opportunity. And if you have, you know, the connections and the interest to do it, and, you know, my interest was education, my passion was education. And I was like, I cannot leave my residents sitting at home 5 days a week doing nothing. Of course, they were doing other things like building pizza ovens and and teaching school for their kids and things like that. But that was a weird opportunity. I was able to leverage, you know, the people I know who were then able to leverage it on up to get, you know, support to fund that. And then that was what people now know me as. They're like, oh, you were the virtual Grand Rounds host. And I never met a single one of them, but I love hearing from each of them that like how important that was for them to maintain some normalcy and something to look forward to as far as something educational, something useful. Three times a week, it was a pain in the butt for me because I had to find speakers and some of these speakers had never used Zoom. I had to teach them how to hit the little green button that said share screen. And then, you know, their camera was pointing the wrong direction or how to smudge. And so I was doing dry runs with people, a whole bunch of work, but you know, it was important to me and it kept me busy during the pandemic. So you just never know what an opportunity is going to be. Be prepared, obviously, and be open to adjusting, right? Like that is never anything that you asked me 20 years ago could be even be a thing, a virtual grand rounds host or co-host. Now it's, you know, virtual visiting professors is a regular thing. And, programs do it all the time because you don't have to fly somebody out and put them in a hotel, but it is funny, opportunities abound and you just never know where they're going to come from. And so you take a chance. And so like I had the opportunity to meet with both of you ladies, and whether that inspires you to, you know, do plastic surgery or just surgery, is, you know, just that little moment in time and you just never know that butterfly effect, how it trickles forward. I met when I was an intern, a woman who was a plastic surgery resident that she was also Asian. And so the nurses kept mistaking us.
That has happened to me so many times. Like, it's insane.
So then I was determined to meet her because I was like, I have to meet whoever this doppelganger is. And then when I met her, she was super cool. And she kind of also continued to spark my interest in plastic surgery by kind of being like, look what we did and come do this case with us and things like that. So she's now faculty in Houston, Texas at the VA. And so it can just be a little coincidence, right? Like I just happened to be the intern at the hospital when she was also at the hospital, and they just kept calling me Dr. Leong, and I was like, I'm not Dr. Leong. So it's little moments like that that will shape your career, and you don't even realize it till you look back like 20 years later, and you're like, oh my gosh, that was so random, but that made a little difference in my trajectory.
Well, thank you so
Wow,
much.
that's amazing.
I think now would be a good time to move on to some of the more fun questions. So personally, I just
Cool.
want to know, who's your secret favorite child, Mochi or Lulu?
So unfortunately, it's definitely still Mochi. I've had him since he was a puppy, and so I raised him as a pup. And so he is super loyal to me. I'm his mama, obviously. He follows me around. If you've ever had a Pomeranian, you know, if I'm eating, he's right there. If I'm peeing, he's right there. If I'm going to the bathroom to wash my hands, he's like, I'm watching you. And so he knows all of my little quirks and habits. Lulu is adorable, and I think my residents prefer her because she's much more of a lap dog, and she will happily sit in anybody's lap. But she's a more naughty one. So I rescued her at about 8 months old, and she has chewed through several tags on clothing, iPhone chargers, rugs, pillowcases, and other things that she can get her little 5 pound mouth on. So I'm more likely mad at her. So Mochi's my boy.
We won't tell Lulu.
She's learning. I've only had her for about a year and a half, and she's very sweet.
We'll have to get you to send us some of the pictures with your dogs so we can put them with the episode so everybody can see how cute they are.
Oh, I think I saw one, didn't I? I was holding them in my driveway.
Yeah, I think so. We have the one in the blue
Cool.
dress with the dog.
Amazing to post it.
Well, this is just something we ask every Wiser podcast guest. What is one song that you think would be worth adding to our Wiser OR music playlist?
Oh, I'm a terrible person for this, actually.
Oh.
So you could ask my residents. I don't have a musical preference. Music is not my thing, and I let the residents pick the jams. And I'm generally tuned out of the music, and I don't even notice when it's on the same songs. As you know from a free flap surgery, it's kind of long. And eventually the residents are like, we're replaying the same songs. And I'm like, oh, really? I didn't notice. I've never been to concerts. I don't own music CDs. It's really super weird, but yeah, I don't have a clue.
Well, never mind then. Are you more of a TV and movie person? Okay.
Yes. I admit to watching horrible reality TV, and that's my weakness, but I don't listen to music regularly.
So then I guess instead, what's something that people should watch right now?
One of my favorites is always Top Chef. I love amazing people who can make amazing food in like 20 minutes when I can barely make spaghetti and meatballs some days. So it's something I am just always amazed by. And I think it's just pure talent that people are sometimes just born with, and it's spectacular. And sometimes though you hear it's, you know, pure determination too, right? Lots and lots and lots of practice. And I think that's similar to what we do in surgery. There's a certain amount of talent that gets you so far, but the rest of it is lots of hard work. So, yeah, I'm a foodie, so I like watching the food, and then I aspire to eat it. So, I'm still trying to eat my way through Atlanta, and Mujo is the next on my list, but I haven't made it there yet.
Is that one of the new Michelin ones?
It's a sushi omakase place, and
Yeah.
it's booked out for like 3 months, so it's really hard to get into.
Easier than your OR day, though.
Yeah, easier to get into than my clinic, but yes, it's supposed to be amazing, I hear. And you just sit down and the chef just brings out amazing food. So I think sometimes it's similar in surgery, right? You just trust your surgeon to do it, and you just trust the chef to give you great food.
Amazing. Well, now I'm very hungry.
It's kind of midday. It's not quite lunch or dinner.
Might have to make an exception.
Yeah. So, you know what? I did want to send you some updated photos. I don't know if you saw on Instagram, I hosted Galentine's Day for my residents and some of our breast surgeons and fellows and team. So I do that once a year. I do a girls-only event just to remind us how awesome we are and how, we're here to support each other. So I'll send you some new pictures. I did that on Sunday. We had high tea. Then we did flower arranging.
I did see that. That looked like it was a lot of fun. Yeah, it looks super fun.
Yeah, so that's a fun way. I bring back some of the graduates who are in the community and our current residents, and so they can meet each other. Because sometimes you hear these names of people from, years past, but you don't necessarily know them, and so it reconnects everybody because I've trained all of them or I know all of them, so it's lots of fun.
That's awesome. What a full circle moment it sounds like for you.
It was the same day as Super Bowl, so I knew that some of the guys were getting together to watch the game, and I think I do this because when I was a resident, there were always the guys going out with the male attendings to either have drinks, hunt, because I was in Texas, or play golf that I was never invited to. And I was like, when I'm the attending, I'm going to have women's events that the guys aren't invited to. And it's cool because when I first started doing it, there were only a handful of us, but this year there were 15 of us. So our numbers are growing by leaps and bounds, and so it'll only get better.
Well, on that note, I think that's a great place for us to wrap up. We just want to thank you so much for joining us today and for being with us on another episode of Wiser. We loved hearing about your life and your career, and we're so excited that our listeners are going to get to know you a little bit better as well. Thank you so
Awesome.
much.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Wiser. If you liked this episode, please rate and leave a review as it helps others find the show. You can also share it with friends and family. Follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Wiser Podcast for updates.